Tonight, we move on to our next two commandments, commandments 5 and 6. And there is a shift that's happening here. If you remember a couple weeks ago in the introduction, we talked about the commandments as having two tables, or in the old language, two tablets. Commandments 1 through 4 are considered the first table, and 5 through 10 are considered the second table. The first table have to do with our religious relationships, our relationship with God. And then the second table have to do with our human and societal relationships. And so tonight, as we move to commandment 5 and 6, we move to that second table. What does it look like to be connected, the covenant relationship, inside the circle of human beings, both in our, in this case, our family, and then our society? And significantly, those commandments, and I want to be careful how I describe this, because I don't want to give the sense that one commandment is more important than the other, but it is generally thought that the second table of commandments are organized by impact on society or by severity. So do not kill is above do not covet, that kind of idea. And interestingly enough, that second table begins with honor your father and your mother. And so the idea there is that there's something fundamental in this commandment for God's people. There is something at stake significantly, and that this commandment has a tremendous impact on how people live in a community group or in a society. And just, we'll come back to this later, but the full commandment is, honor your father and mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. So this is on the way to the promised land, and it anticipates a movement of the people into the promised land. There's also a slight difference of translation in these, but in this commandment, between Deuteronomy and Exodus, but we'll talk about that down the road. It is interesting, again, that before we get to the do's and don'ts for society, we have a commandment about being family, because so much of who we are and how we function in the world, we inherit from our upbringing, from our family structure, for better or worse. And so it is intriguing, I think, that before God gets to don't murder and don't lie and don't steal and all of that stuff, there is a commandment about the home. There is a commandment about familial relationships and honoring those whose job it is to teach you and raise you. And the word honor here is an interesting word. It literally means, in the Hebrew, it means a weight or a burden. So it's something placed upon you. It gets a ton. There are some words in Hebrew that when you look at the way those words are translated, you get a column of options. And this is one of them. It's translated rich. It's translated grievous, respected. This is the word used of Pharaoh when his heart is hardened. And the idea is that it places a burden, that it's more of what's deserved. So you're weighed down either with honor and respect if you deserve that, or punishment and ridicule if you deserve that. And so it's a very interesting word as it is translated here, honor, what is due, to take care of, to care for. This is a Martin Luther quote, and we're Presbyterians, but every once in a while, Martin Luther says something that we should know. So I'll give him some credit here. Luther wrote this: it's a greater thing to honor than it is to love. Honor includes love, but also self-discipline, humility, and respect. It requires us not only to address them in friendship and with reverence, but above all, to relate to them from both the heart and the body, as to show them that one thinks much of them and regards them as next to God. So there is this idea of hierarchy. for Luther and for the church. And this is where I think the conversation has some depth, because Luther goes on to point out that this is not based on a parent's inherent worth. Luther himself had pretty rough experience as a child. And so Luther also writes that parenting is an ordination to responsibility. And so Luther not only has an expectation of how children behave toward their parents, but he understands there is a responsibility of how parents behave toward their children. And there are, of course, those situations where parents don't deserve much honor. If they are abusive, if they're offensive, if they keep us from growth in the faith, if they are not moral, not ethical, that honor in those situations doesn't simply mean to go along, and it doesn't mean to pretend and pat them on the back like they're good if they're not. And so parents are to aspire to be worthy of honor, and children are to aspire to honor their parents. And I know that this can be a difficult conversation, because the wounds of our childhood are the ones that run the deepest. I never thought I would quote this book, but some of you may know the book, The Shack. Don't read it if you haven't. But there is a line in it that has always stuck with me. It says, "I suppose that since most of our hurts come through relationships, so too will our healing." And in those moments where family life is difficult, this commandment should not be seen as a burden, but an opportunity to work toward those things like forgiveness, those things like support and understanding. But it may not mean, and I would argue that it certainly doesn't mean, tolerate indecent behavior from your parents, or even perhaps worse, transfer that on to your own children. I think that is, honoring God has to come before honoring parents. And if parents don't deserve honor, then we'd have to have a conversation. So this is a general kind of commandment, and one that we could split some hairs on in tough situations.
This commandment occupies the position that it does in the two books, I think, for a couple specific reasons. And one is, just to be very practical, it transitions from our idea with our relationship with God to our relationship with physical people, our family, and the structure of that. And that makes sense. Think about the people to whom this is given. An ancient people who are going to be going into this land. In fact, we have that here, this idea that their lives may be long in the land in which they're going. And the idea of honoring your father and mother in that context is essential to life. It creates order and structure so that you have a society that can do the things that you need to do, certainly to set up camp and to have the food that you need and the order with which they would need to do it, but also the requirement of being able to deal with distributing land and all of these kinds of things that we're going to see happen in the later books as Israel starts to really take hold of that land. The idea of a strong family unit is an important part of that. So there's a real physical aspect to this. There's also, I think, a real, as we've already intuited, in the relationship between God and humanity, that there's real theological meaning in that. And that bridge is also happening with this commandment, because as we are called to honor our father and mother, the commentators make very clear point, the reformers were very clear to name, that there is one other person that you call father besides your biological father. It's the one that Jesus taught us to pray to, our Father who art in heaven. So therefore, there's theological significance about this commandment, because the people who we call mother and father represent, even if in small measure, they represent a relationship with a heavenly father. and not perfectly, and they're broken, and they have all of those elements, but there is a spiritual element to this command. And that is certainly where a lot of Reformed theologians would dig in, and they have given us a real a legacy of thought that we're going to engage here quickly with tonight. But I do think that it does for us today in a very practical sense. If it has real physical societal impact for the Israelites and it teaches us something about God, I think that it gives us modern Christians a lot to wrestle with as we see our culture in general dealing with the question of family in some really generative and interesting ways. People are asking questions about what these relationships look like and what a society, a well-founded society should be. And a commandment like this doesn't answer those questions for Christians necessarily, but it means that we need to care about it. It's something built into God's intended relationship for us, that we have good family societal relationships. That matters to God. And so therefore, for Christians, it should matter to us.
And probably along those lines, our people, it's interesting, when we hear the commandment, we almost think exclusively of families. I mean, literally the words, father and mother. What is intriguing is that those who have read this and thought about this and studied this have expanded far beyond that. And so our Reformed people used this commandment to talk about how we show respect in society, how we show respect to elders, how we show respect to bosses, to leaders, to the elderly, how we show respect and deference to one another in a society. And so while we tend to take, in the modern world, the modern reading, we tend to take these words literally, our father and mother, the Reformers expanded this commandment greatly and talked about how it is that we relate to people. And we want to be careful with this language because it can be very problematic. They live in a hierarchical world. So the conversation is, how do we treat people both above us and below us? And the language they use for that is uncomfortable, I think. They talk about our superiors and our inferiors. But they don't mean that morally. They mean that in terms of livelihood, education, status and position. They mean that sort of on the ladder of society, some people are higher than we are and some people are lower. And what are our obligations in both directions? And what I think is interesting about that is most people don't hear that in the commandment. But if you look at what Westminster says about this one, they say more about that really than about family relationships. The family relationships are sort of assumed, but they really go in on this idea of how do we show respect and honor, et cetera, in the classes of our society. And I think that's a challenge for us because I think we often don't think in those terms. Though most of us are, you know, most of us are probably done with the front half of our life, most of us in here. I've got to make 110, I guess. So, you know, it's reasonable that we've got half probably finished. If you're my, you know, I remember, and this was a common, this wasn't unusual. I remember being told, you don't speak when adults are speaking. I didn't always listen to that. I didn't always follow that, but that was the clear expectation. There are adults here. You don't do that. You don't talk back to teachers, which again happened occasionally. But the point was those things were always expected. And there were times when adults may have been in the wrong and the counsel from my family was still, that doesn't matter. They are your piano teacher or Sunday school teacher or whatever. You say, yes, ma'am, yes, sir. Keep your mouth shut. Now, that's not always the best counsel, but it does show this kind of undergirding idea of respect and how at times we've tried to fold that into society. It's just that most of us wouldn't think about that here in this commandment, but our Reformed people very much did.
This is built upon another concept that I think, if we hear it rightly, makes us a little uncomfortable, especially as 21st century Americans, because ultimately the commandment is saying you owe something to your parents, to your mother and father. You owe them honor. And that gets transferred through the Reformed thought to all superiors. So the question becomes, what do you owe to those ahead of you? And what do you owe to those behind you? That's not great terminology. Bear with me. They don't mean that people are actually ahead or behind. They just mean we have different vocations and roles. So if your role is over some people, then you are responsible. You owe them that you're looking out for their best interest. And likewise, if there are people who are overseeing you in your vocational role, that their job is to be looking out. It goes both ways. And that becomes very, I think, difficult for us to engage with in a secular society. Because think of this with me for just a moment. If a Christian is having a conversation with a non-Christian, and you're talking about what we owe to one another, you could get on the same page about humanity. But even the secular person can say, well, all humans are living. So since they're living, we should treat each other nicely. We should try to take care of the other people because as long as they're a human, they're worthy of some of our respect. That's a great perspective. A Christian comes at that from a very different perspective. Christians who believe that you were made in God's image, each and every one of the people in this room, we believe are made in the image of God. And so we also believe that every person out of this room is made in the image of God. So when we answer the question, why should you care for the other? What do you owe to the other? The answer is, I owe to the other what God tells me is owed to that person because they're an image bearer of the God who made them. They're a child of God, right? So the commandment we're going to get to, do not murder, follows this command on purpose. Why? You don't murder someone made in the image of God. What you owe them is whatever you can do to further their life in the best sense possible. What you owe them is that in your leadership over them, they flourish as best as you're able. And so Christians come to this conversation about owing, at least the Reformed tradition, that we talk about this idea of what we owe one another is the thing that we owe them because of who God made them to be. And that's different from a worldly perspective. If you want to make that me sort of share that in a really simple way, when the school wants to talk to kids about not being bullies, they say we shouldn't be bullies. Why? Because that's not nice. Christians would say you shouldn't be a bully because you're bullying God's child. That's a radically different understanding of the nature of the problem. And then it leads us into different ways of talking about the solution. And so what we owe to one another is part of this commandment because ultimately mother and father are creatures of God and we are to learn in our relationship with them the proper way to relate to God himself through their imperfect nature.
I want to read just a little bit of this. And again, I certainly want you to listen to these words through the lens of father and mother, whichever side of that you have or haven't lived on, but also I want you to hear it through the lens of a boss, an older person, a younger person, whatever else the inferior, superior relationship might be, the above and below kind of language. So, here's the first one, and I'm not going to talk about the requires because you'll kind of get them. I'm going to read the sins. What are the sins of inferiors against their superiors? And by hearing the sins, you'll get the what is required. The sins of inferiors toward their superiors are the neglect of duties required toward them, envying, contempt of, rebellion against their persons and places in their lawful councils, commands, and correction, cursing, mocking, and all such scandalous carriage as proves a shame and a dishonor to them and their government. So again, we have here the idea that these are not simply individuals, these are the structures of society. I'm pointing this at nobody, but imagine the comfort level that we have seen from Christians over the last few years in how they talk about government leaders. And I don't care what side of politics you're on. I don't care if you're left and you don't like the right, or right and you don't like the left. We constantly see cursing, mocking, contempt directed at those who are our superiors. And our people would have some questions about that. Now, do those who govern have to govern honorably? Yes. Should they be held accountable when they don't? Yes, of course. But how we treat, act, and speak of those above us, our people think fall under this commandment. Now, we might not want to think that, but it is an interesting, I find it challenging. When you expand this commandment, it starts to get tricky in a hurry, I think.
So I want to quick make sure that we all feel comfortable with how we get here, because this isn't just the reformers doing theology. This is in your Bible, actually. If you want to look up later, Ephesians chapter 6, I'm going to read you just a little bit of this, but we have a quotation of this commandment in the New Testament. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. And then here's what immediately follows it up. Listen to this. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. Isn't that incredible? The commandment to children is immediately followed by a commandment to the parents of what they should not do. Do not exasperate your children. So there's immediately a correction to that. And then this is going to get a little uncomfortable, but it's important that we wade into this. The very next word after to fathers is, slaves, obey your earthly masters. And then just a paragraph later, and masters, treat your slaves in the same way. So the New Testament, we very clearly have the same interpretation that the commandment to honor father and mother is the very commandment for how we behave in our social, organized, even civic and business relationships. And so this idea of then turning to, like, where Paul says that we should live peaceably among all men, we can see very clearly how the early church had this understanding that how we treat those above us, and how we speak of those, whatever role that they occupy, is a way of practicing how we treat God himself and the way in which we're seeking to try to be the kind of people who revere and honor God with our lives. So it's a way of pointing us in our social and governmental and societal relationships.
So then let's flip then for a moment. And here is the next, well, it's not the next, but a few questions down. This is where Westminster goes. What are the sins of the superior? So now we're thinking either about those who are above us or how we treat those who are underneath of us. The sins of the superiors are, besides the neglect of duties required of them, an inordinate seeking of themselves, their own glory, ease, profit, or pleasure, commanding things unlawful or not in the power of inferiors to perform, counseling, encouraging, or favoring that in which is evil, dissuading, discouraging, discountenancing them in that which is good, correcting them unduly, careless, exposing or leaving of them to wrong, temptation, and danger, provoking them to wrath, or any way dishonoring themselves or lessening their authority by an unjust, indiscreet, rigorous, or remiss behavior. So again, our people, when they talked about what are our responsibilities to those underneath of us, our children, or those who work for us, or whatever that relationship might be, asking them to do something they're not capable of. That's on us. That's a fault. Putting them in situations that they are exposed to temptation. It is the superior's task to navigate the moral situation of an inferior, right? And if you've raised children, you know that. Hey, can I go to this place? What's going on there? Doesn't sound like a good idea. Sounds like a place where you'd have lots of opportunities to make poor decisions. Maybe you shouldn't do that. We navigate that. But this not only has inside the house consequences, it has inside society consequences. And so there is a balance. The idea is, in many ways, like marriage, that there is a give and take, and that we need not worry about such titles as superior and inferior if both are living out their Christian duty and their Christian obligation toward one another. We wouldn't have to worry about being taken advantage of.
So just very briefly, I don't want to, we need to be moving on, but I don't want to leave this on the table. This really generated a lot of thought for me this week, and so I want to share it with you. I was just recently at a gathering of pastors here locally, and those gatherings always are thought-provoking in lots of different ways. And this particular command from Westminster, question 132, is about one of the sins of equals, people who are responsible to each other. This is, it's very short. The sins of equals are, besides the neglect of the duties that were required for one another, the things we owe one another, here they are: the undervaluing of the worth of the other person, envying their gifts, grieving at their own advancement or prosperity, and usurping preeminence over one another. Woof. Those are strong words that we could all use a dose of every day. Someone else's advancement does not detract from you. Someone else's gift does not take from yours. Someone else's moment and time has nothing to say with the gifts that you've been given. And this is a real temptation, I think, of leaders, is we, and I mean that in every context. I mean leaders in the home, I think leaders in our community, leaders who are volunteering. Every time that we're engaging with one another, we are given an opportunity to see God's good works at work in another, to celebrate that, or to see that from a negative slant and bend it towards ourselves. And I think that this commandment, as the reformers clearly saw it, is an invitation not just to honor father and mother, although that's the clear literal implication, but also to learn what it means to treat others rightly, to owe them what it means to be the love and care of a child of God, and to then proceed from that.
We're going to move on then. Our next commandment, number 6, we again think here of society and the building of a stable place where people can live out their life and their faith in covenant and in safety. And so we get to this very important commandment, do not kill. 3 words in English, 2 words plus an article, a letter in Hebrew. Sounds so simple. But there may not be any commandment that has generated more amendments and discussions and qualifications historically. We start with do not kill, which sounds pretty easy. But then we have, what about capital punishment? What about suicide? What about war? What about soldiers? What about armies? What about governments? In the modern world, what about abortion? We have struggled with this command to know what it does and doesn't say in the extent of society. The King James Version says, you shall not kill. And most people I'm making some generalities here, but bear with me. Most people who say they take the Bible literally read or prefer the King James Version, but they don't take this literally. Because the more conservative a Christian is, ironically, the more chance they're for capital punishment, the more they're okay with soldiers. In fact, they may celebrate military strength. And so, though the King James Version says kill, even literalists don't take that literally. And most modern translations have substituted the word murder because it implies a more personal relationship, a one-on-one, not governmental or societal, but relational word. Some translations may even use the word slay, which is probably along the lines of the Hebrew there. But every one of these instances stresses the idea of the taking of a life. That's the idea of the verb. Thou shall not take life. Now, the problem, or one of the problems with this commandment, Jesus said something about it. And when Jesus says something about it, it usually makes things worse. And that's what he did here. He said, yeah, you've heard, don't kill. I tell you, if you're angry at your brother, your sister, if you harbor anger in your heart, you have murdered them. You are guilty of murder. So Jesus equates to kill with to hate or be angry, to cut off another one or wish ill towards another one. So it's not only that which takes life, it's that which severs relationship. And now you take a commandment that seemed not that hard to follow, and it just got really tricky. It got really big.
And then we keep, and it goes even deeper. Because Westminster is going to gloss this commandment this way. It's going to say, whatever tends to the destruction of the life of any. Whatever tends towards the destruction of life of any. And then they take that in some really wide sweeping ways. Because by that standard, this could potentially be one of the biggest commands that we have, especially when you think we started with, thou shalt not murder. You would think we would just say, that's been nice. Glad to have you here tonight. We'll see you all later, right? That's clear. It's practical. But if you take Westminster seriously, the things that cause destruction in the lives of others, then it causes us to ask questions about how do we live our life in such a way that tends towards the furtherance of the life of others? And in what ways do our lives get in the way of other people's lives continuing to grow? So things in Westminster that come out, things that might cause injury to other people, or things that might put us in position to do harm to others. One of the ones I did find very interesting was the immoderate use of meat. Sorry for all of you smokers out there and grill lovers. No, but the idea of wanton excess, right? In the ancient world, meat was a thing of high dollar and high value. So the idea of are you immoderately pleasuring yourself with things that is actively going to do harm to your neighbor? If you have, does it take from them? And that includes drink. The idea that maybe in immoderation, you are going to do or treat others in a way that they shouldn't be. Then it goes on, revenge, envy, anger. And that ultimately, right before the giving of the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy, one of the things that God says as a preamble to the commandment is that God desires for the people to have a long life. So what's interesting is, here we have a commandment that forbids you from taking someone's life. Why? Because that keeps them from enjoying the gift that God intends for them to have. If they're made in the image of God, God desires for them in his image to have a long life, to live a prosperous life. And and murder will keep that from happening. So therefore, is not an action which is given to us to do. The taking of life wantonly.
Yeah, there's also some language in the New Testament. Don't take revenge. That's up to God. God will make those decisions. God will act on your behalf. You don't have the authority to do that. And again, this is one of those commandments. I bet most of us, when we read the commandments and we feel convicted by them, this is probably one we go by and feel kind of safe, right? I haven't murdered anybody. I'm not saying I haven't wanted to now and then. Well, I've never done it. But what does it mean to live in a way that is life-giving towards others and not life-detracting? And that doesn't mean just not doing wrong to others. It means failing to do right. Again, read a little Luther this week, and Luther said, if you see someone hungry and you could have fed them, then you starve them. And if you see someone naked, unclothed, and you could have clothed them, then you let him freeze. In other words, what you didn't do to make someone's life better, you are guilty of, as if you were responsible for it, because God calls us to care for others. And this is tough. You know, again, our Presbyterian people, we've tended to governmentalize this commandment. We tend to talk about it as the power of the state and rulers, that they're vested with the authority to take life and the order of taking life in criminal considerations. The idea of a just war, that's a reformed idea. The idea that there are causes that are justly pursued, and if that means taking life. You know, our own guy, John Calvin, once sentenced a heretic to be burned. So he's got do not kill, and he burned a guy, or had him burned. He didn't, I don't think he did it, but he didn't stop it. And I don't know what Luther would say about that, because Luther was not big on heretics either. But this gets messy. We've tended to neglect the other side that is our responsibility to protect and help and intervene. And I think this is a very interesting time in the world to be asking about this commandment. We live in a global society. We live in a first world economy, a capitalism, a marketplace economy. So what does it mean to live our life in a way that doesn't harm the lives of others? How many of you like cashews? I hope I'm not about to ruin this for you. I'm a cashew fan. I order cashew chicken when we get Chinese food. I eat cashews. The trail mix, the cashews always disappear first, Jane will tell you, then the M&Ms, but the cashews go first. Does anybody know anything about cashews? So they grow in these little pods, and those pods are acidic. If you tear them open, they burn your hand. So the primary cashew market is in places where there are little villages where women with old gloves and bread sacks on their hands break open cashews for very little money. After somebody climbs trees and gets them, they end up with chemical burns all up and down their hands and their arms so that they can then pass the cashew on to people who make a lot more out of the cashew, so we can complain about them being $4 a pound or whatever they are. Yeah, way more than that. But that money isn't getting to the people who are burning their hands picking our cashews. So what does it mean to live my life in a way that doesn't detract from the life of someone else in an economy, in a society? That's easy relationally. I mean, it's not easy, but it's maybe simpler. If I want to talk about our relationships, your relationships, we could maybe figure that out. I think it's a very difficult moment for us to dive into what does it mean societally What does it mean that we live in a place with a lot of haves when there are so many places in the world that are have-nots? I think this is the commandment, ironically enough, that through the lens of Westminster would ask us that question.
I think one way to frame this is that this is a commandment that in its spiritual interpretation is a commandment of orientation. So if you, at the sound of my voice, say to yourself, I have not murdered anyone, commandment kept. Good. Let's move to the next step. And that is, are you oriented to the furthering, life-giving work of God in every other person that you can? And that orientation is going to lead you in lots of different ways. But we live in a world which is very skeptical. We live in a world which is very negative. We live in a world where the thing that trends is the thing about, can you believe that this person did this crazy off-the-wall thing? And instead of Christians buying into that, I think that this commandment does call us, in all of the complexities of economy and government policies and all those things that are, quite frankly, above my pay grade, the thing that this commandment calls us towards is, it may not give you a specific outlay of what you should do in each one of those things. It does say you should always be oriented to the thing that helps another person thrive. Because when you do that, you're then in that person allowing God's image to be seen more clearly. That's what God wants for that child of God. And so therefore, that should be your goal in every situation as far as it concerns you. And I think I just would like to leave you with the question, if that's what we as a church, and I mean that not just in the sense of First Presbyterian Church, but like if the American church was known for concerted and energetic attempts at every turn to try to further life in other people, how different of a conversation that would be in the public square than the ones that so often happen. And I realize that Presbyterians aren't generally the ones on the street corner waving floppy Bibles. Okay, I understand that. But there is a way in which every time we enter out into public life and we advocate for and push for and encourage others to create systems that are fair and to create a world which helps others live into their God image-ness, when we've done that, we're in some way living into this command. And saying that doesn't get rid of the complexities of that, right? We all know that. We all know that navigating this world, it has to be weighed with what's in the best interest of what we can do and what a government can do. We realize that this is big. But I think one of the mistakes of modernity, one of the mistakes of having a device, a smartphone that connects you to the world, is we can become overwhelmed by the complexity of the world and therefore not do good where we can. And to whatever extent it is able to you, our forebears would tell us, we owe to the other to encourage life in them. And that is a good orientation for us to seek to have.
I hope there's been a takeaway. Again, I think some of the wisdom of our mothers and fathers in the faith, I think is helpful because it does expand our idea far past the simple words that might be written on the page and point us toward the idea of what is it God might ask of us through those things. And I think, again, these two commandments are remarkably, I mean, honor your father and mother can be challenging for sure, but I think we find that as we dig into these, they're both deeper than they might appear on the surface, and they take us in some challenging and hopefully exciting and life-giving direction. So thank you all for being here. Thanks again for food. I think the sign up is over there. I don't know what it looks like, but again, thanks for those to make sure that we continue to get a chance to have these meals. We're very, very grateful.
Hey, we want to thank you for listening to this broadcast. We're grateful for the support and the connections, the relationships we get to make through some of these offerings. We hope that they've been helpful. We know that there are lots of choices that you have, lots of things you can listen to. We want to make you aware of some of what we're doing, and we greatly appreciate you being a part of it.
Absolutely. We want to just thank you for being one of our audio podcast listeners. It's amazing to have you with us in the midst of our conversations. Of course, I hope you know that you can find the whole archive of all of these conversations at pastortalk.co. We would love for you to join us there. You can find options for subscribing by email. You can easily share things there with other people who you think might appreciate recordings like this. And of course, we just want to welcome you. If you're ever interested in joining us for the video podcast, you can do that on YouTube. It is youtube.com/FPC Spirit Lake. There you can comment and engage with us. Or if you would prefer to do that without going to YouTube, you can actually just click the link in the description of this podcast, where you will be able to send us a form and information and reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you and engage in conversation with you. Thanks again for taking time to be with us. We look forward to our next conversation and can't wait to see you then.